Welcome to the Arab Spring, a history. Episode 16, Suez Crisis. During the early years of Nasser's rule in Egypt, he had one overriding goal, the construction of a huge dam for the Nile near Aswan. It would increase the area which could be cultivated by a third, provide water during droughts, and be a source of hydroelectricity. Egypt was still very backwards, and the Aswan Dam was to be crucial in Egypt's development. It was a great plan, with just one flaw. Egypt had no method to pay for it. The solution to this would be to take out a loan. In February 1956, it was agreed that the World Bank would be willing to fund the project, providing $200 million as a loan, but the United States and Britain would loan an extra $70 million to pay hard currency costs. This loan would come with several conditions, which were very hard to accept. Eventually, Nasser gave in and agreed. But once he had, the US pulled out. The United States said that Egypt was simply too unstable to make such an investment. They wanted to break Nasser down and reduce his confidence and make him easy to control. And they didn't count on the Soviet Union making good on its offer to finance the dam. In addition, US President Dwight Eisenhower was very much annoyed by Nasser's attempts to play the Soviets and Americans off each other. The relationship between Nasser and the West was beyond repair. Nasser made this abundantly clear with an announcement on the fourth anniversary of the revolution, the 26th of July, 1956. Nasser announced that he was nationalising the Suez Canal Company. The canal would now be run by an Egyptian canal authority. The Suez Canal was not just a canal. It represented Western colonialism, and taking it away from the West delighted the Third World, and horrified the First. Nasser must not be allowed to succeed. This resulted in 3 months of negotiations in London and New York, as Britain took charge, trying to bring about international ownership of the canal. This came to nothing due to a disagreement in procedure. I spoke last time of British views over the Middle East against those of the United States. Britain was still determined to maintain its dominance, as was France, though America was less inclined to do this, at least directly, preferring to act through its allies, Turkey and Iran, as well as financing Israel. Britain and France wanted to use military action to cajole Nasser into giving in, while the Eisenhower administration would not go this far. This reluctance on the part of Eisenhower would not prevent Britain and France from taking action. The French had formed a secret alliance with Israel to form a plan to invade Egypt with Britain, which eventually Prime Minister Eden agreed to. Eden was deeply worried that if it came out that Britain had colluded with Israel against Egypt, her reputation with the Arab states would be beyond recovery. Soon enough, on the 29th of October 1956, Israel invaded Sinai. The next day, Britain and France issued an ultimatum to Egypt and Israel to end the fighting and withdraw their forces from 10 miles of the canal. Israel immediately accepted the ultimatum despite the fact that their troops were nowhere near the canal anyway, putting pressure on Egypt and Nasser to withdraw. Nasser refused to agree, and moved his troops, which were not faring well, back across the canal. The ultimatum expired on the 31st of October, and Britain and France launched retaliation against Egypt. Airfields were bombed, with almost the entire air force destroyed. They launched a ground assault on the 5th of November, which landed near Port Said, and made its way southwards along the lines of the canal, which had been blocked with sunken ships by the Egyptians. Despite the best efforts of the British, French, and Israelis, the action was not coming across well internationally. The United States was fiercely opposed to what was going on, threatening to cease aiding the British currency. The Soviet Union made threats, and the British Commonwealth looked likely to fall apart. The UN called for a ceasefire, and created a force to oversee it on the 4th of November. Finally, on November 6th, the British and French troops agreed to end the fighting. This was a very good result for Egypt. It had been militarily defeated on the Suez, but a combined force of pressure from the US and USSR had allowed Egypt to achieve victory without having to choose sides, allowing her to maintain her ideas of Arab neutralism. Israel was forced to move out of Sinai and Gaza by a furious President Eisenhower, while Britain and France were forced out of Egypt. Property of these nations was sequestered, and the people expelled. Upset, Britain and France sought to blockade Egypt economically, but this went nowhere. Nasser was riding high on a wave of popularity across the region, from fellow Egyptians and Arabs. He didn't want to pick sides in the conflict, and thus effectively played the Soviets and Americans off each other, accepting aid from both, but aligning himself to neither. Military aid came in from the USSR, while America provided considerable food aid, valued at $643 million between 1954 and 1966, which greatly helped Egypt's internal security, though this was cut off in the mid-1960s due to Egyptian involvement in the Yemeni Civil War. Despite being highly popular with his own people, and the Arabs as a whole, Nasser was deeply unpopular with most of the Arab leadership, who were distinctly pro-Western. But before I go too far ahead, we're going to have to go back. This stage of Middle Eastern history is becoming a lot more interconnected than the first 50 years of our period, and so, rather than tell each country's story individually, as I've done before, there'll be a fair bit more dual storytelling, as we did with the creation of Israel a few episodes ago. Right now, we turn to Jordan. We last left Jordan under the Hashemite King Abdullah, who had managed to gain administrative control of the West Bank during the creation of Israel, to create the Kingdom of Jordan. Abdullah was effectively a British puppet. The British subsidised a large part of his army, though he had dreams of unifying the Arab world. This was why he was so eager to take control of the Palestinians, and had agreed not to fight Israel under the understanding that Jordan would gain the West Bank. This was deeply upsetting to the Jordanians, and in 1951, Abdullah was assassinated, leaving his son Talal to take the throne. Talal will play almost no part in our story. He was not in a good state of mental health, suffering from schizophrenia. He abdicated in 1952, leaving the throne to his son, Hussein. While many Arab leaders opposed Nasserism, Hussein was quite lenient, and allowed a pro-Nasser government to be formed. this government started acting in ways which Hussein was likely not comfortable with. For instance, in October 1956, the agreement with the British to support the Jordanian army was scrapped. Egypt and Syria agreed to try and replace this subsidy. Saudi Arabia agreed to do this too. Now ruled by King Saud, who had succeeded his father, our old friend Ibn Saud. Things continued to move in a Nasserist direction, and in April 1957, Hussein found out that his government was planning to open negotiations with the Soviet Union, and there was a nationalist element in his army which was planning to overthrow him in a coup, just as Nasser had overthrown the monarchy in Egypt. This was the final straw. While this element was opposed to Hussein, the Bedouin elements of his army were fiercely loyal, and he was able to dismiss the government. The loyalty of the Bedouin was a huge factor in this, but another was that Jordan was in a rather precarious situation. Remember when I told you of how weak a position Jordan was in tactically? Possessing very little? Yeah, that was still the case. Jordan needed every advantage it could get, being surrounded by such powerful neighbours, Israel especially. Should Hussein be killed, then Jordan would be thrown into a state of chaos, and it would be very easy for Israel to simply take the West Bank back. This would be one of a number of factors, including Hussein's sheer ability, which would help Hussein live into the 1990s. Spoiler alert. As for Lebanon, that was firmly pro-Western. The dominant Christian population made sure of that. But in the grand scheme of things, these were only small potatoes. The real prize was further north, Syria. Once Italy surrendered and the Second World War was pushed out of the Middle East, just what to do with Lebanon and Syria was a rather tricky question. It had been comparatively simple. The French had the mandates for the two countries, but when Hitler invaded France, just who was in command? There were three groups in post-German conquest France: the French under direct German occupation in the north of France, the puppet Vichy government in the southwest of France, and a third group who opposed Germany and Hitler continuing the war with the British, the Free French, led by Charles de Gaulle. Technically, control had passed to Vichy France, but Britain and the Free French had captured the region from them. Britain had done this under the understanding that France would recognise the independence of Syria and Lebanon, but also that France would have a higher position in the independent countries over other European powers, which kinda sounds like the countries weren't independent at all. It didn't help that the decision to recognise independence had been made by de Gaulle's deputy. If you'll allow me a quick quote from Peter Mansfield's A History of the Middle East: "De Gaulle, however, did not believe that the Free French had liberated Syria and Lebanon in order to give them up." So, I think you can see why this situation became complicated. Despite de Gaulle's attempts to create a treaty just short of independence, Syria and Lebanon were having none of it. The merchants of Lebanon, both Christian and Muslim, were opposed to the regulations imposed by the mandate, and they agreed between themselves to maintain Lebanon as an independent state with an Arab foreign policy. When elections in 1943 saw a victory for the anti-mandate party, the French responded by arresting the president of Lebanon, along with most of the government. And to think, the French couldn't understand why the Lebanese didn't want them there. They very quickly released everyone. Once protests from all over the globe and a British ultimatum made them realise how bad of an idea this was. Elections saw a victory for the anti-mandate party in Syria, and the French saw the way the wind was blowing, and gradually transferred power to the two governments. There was one final incident where it became clear the French were trying to leave their military in the country as long as possible, waiting for the British to leave. But after another British ultimatum, the French finally gave in to the inevitable. A year later, in 1946, the French withdrew, and both Syria and Lebanon became independent states and members of the United Nations. Syria was one of the most unstable countries created after World War II. After only 3 years, there was a coup in 1949, followed by another coup later that year, which was followed by a third coup later that year. Yes, three coups in 1949. Not a stable country. In the final of these, Colonel Shishakli came to power, and he would dominate the country until 1954, when he was overthrown in another coup and parliamentary democracy was restored, the parliament being composed of old French parties. Tied between the pro-Western Iraq and Nasserist Egypt, Syria would play a great role in deciding which way the region would go. But this will have to wait until next week, when we shall get into some very interesting history. If you enjoy this podcast, there are several things you can do. You could make a donation through PayPal at thehistoryofpodcast.com. I do spend a lot of my time producing this show, along with its sister shows such as A History of Hannibal, and it would mean a lot if you could financially support it. You could also leave a review on iTunes, so that others know you enjoy it. It takes a few seconds, costs nothing, and is greatly appreciated. I shall see you next time, when we begin to discuss the bath and a very curious creation, the United Arab Republic. Allah.